Can't you see it? The world powered by solar and renewable energy. Here at Graybar, with years of renewables experience, we live in that world. Get in touch to see for yourself.
We are now ready to depart.
Book your visit at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Whether you want to
buy, buy, buy
in a bear market or
sell, sell, sell
in a bull market, Jim Cramer can help you become a better investor. Mad Money, weeknights 6 Eastern. Listen to CNBC on the Odyssey app.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Colly Plaster, communications representative of Clico and Fran Phoenix, communications strategist there. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So, obviously, new budget year. Clico has been great corporate partners for a long, long time. But y'all have an announcement that you want to make today to try and make people aware of what you have available and how you can go about distributing it. So, take it away.
Yes, Clico has been focused on corporate giving since we've been in business. This year, we will actually celebrate 90 years of service. And so as we begin the new year of 2025, we want to make sure our customers know what we're doing in the community through our volunteerism and our corporate giving. So I'll start with the volunteerism. We have a program called Done in a Day, where we go and help various nonprofit organizations with various projects that take a couple of hours or at most a day. We have a team of employees. They volunteer. In the St. Tammany area, we've gone to the Family Promise of St. Tammany. That's a homeless shelter for families and children. We helped with their landscaping. We did some pressure washing and painted. We've gone to the Slidell Animal Control and helped wash dogs. We walk dogs to prepare them for adoption. And we've gone to the North Shore Food Bank. They have a resale store in Covington, and we helped with that facility. So every year we try to do some of these Done in a Day projects across our service territory. And those are some of the things we did in 2024.
I love that approach. Right. I mean, you know, your employees have kind of a sometimes little snippets of time that they can give back to their community. And you guys are work that gatekeeper, so to speak, and align. And it helps everyone. I love it.
And we love doing it. We live in this community. We work in this community, and we do business. And we believe in serving where we, helping where we serve. So we want to always make sure that we give back, and volunteering is one of the ways we do that. In 2024, Newell, we volunteered 4,600 hours of time to over 600 organizations.
That's awesome. That's great. I mean, I love that approach. Now, you also, you guys have monies set aside as well. So tell us about corporate giving.
Sure, Newell. That's something that we're also really passionate to be a part of, along with the volunteering. So many organizations across the state that are putting on projects, these charitable organizations, projects to benefit the community, benefit citizens in the community. Like Fran was saying, we've been able to support financially over 600 organizations in 2024. That's things big and small that, you know, you might see it on a billboard somewhere or on a big screen, or it may be small in a community to support them. And so it's been spectacular to get to work with those different programs.
Absolutely. So if there are groups that have a desire to tap in to that corporate giving stream, how do they go about doing that?
Sure. The best way that they can do that is to visit us on our website, clico.com/community. On the community tab of our website, you'll be able to push a button there to apply for some corporate funding.
And you guys, obviously, y'all do this every year. I've heard about it for a long, long time, and you're committed to keep this going, obviously.
Definitely. On the volunteerism side, we even have employees who outside of Done in a Day, they volunteer at the Manor House. That's part of something they do for team building and to give back. So once a month, they set aside time to go to a local Manor House to help box food and just get things ready for distribution. So it's not just giving, you know, we do giving with the corporate grants, but just the fact that employees give up their time and that the company supports it. You know, if Coley or myself want to go to help an organization and it's at a certain time, maybe during work hours, we actually have the opportunity to go and do that because the company is committed to volunteering. We're not about just being in a community and not giving back.
So, Fran, obviously, if you were advising a not-for-profit, the sooner that they establish this relationship within the budget year, the better, right? To make you guys aware of what they're looking for so you can try and determine whether or not you're going to be able to satisfy their request.
Definitely. So as Coley mentioned, if you go to CLECO.com, you're going to click on community and then corporate giving. And we list the criteria for grants. We focus on several areas like STEM. We focus on programs that support the youth, low-income initiatives. If there's a nonprofit in our service area that has some type of program that ties into those initiatives, we definitely encourage you to complete the application and request a grant. It does take, you know, a couple of weeks to hear back. So the sooner you apply, the better. And then on the volunteerism side, if there's a project that someone needs help with, a nonprofit, then you can reach out to us at news@CLECO.com. We'll look at the request and we'll do our best to come out and support that organization.
So thank you all for the opportunity to kind of, you know, get this word out. As you well know, I'm a big believer in the not-for-profit community. They backfill in so many different ways where our government doesn't have the opportunity, doesn't have the resources necessary to do it all. And it really improves our community. And I love the fact that y'all reached out and said, look, we want to let everybody know about this opportunity, and thank you for doing so, and we're happy to do so. And if these opportunities come up again, please let us know. Final thoughts?
Yeah, just one more time. If you're requesting some support from volunteers for a project that we could get done in about a day, you can email to news@CLECO.com. Let us know a little bit about what group you're with, what kind of project you're looking at, and how many hands you might look at needing. And to request funding, you can visit CLECO.com/community to look at corporate giving.
Coley Plaster and Fran Phoenix, thank you so much for joining us. Representatives from CLECO, as I said before, great corporate partners, and we appreciate you guys reaching out. And if there's any way that I can assist in the future getting the word out, let us know. We'd be happy to do so. And Happy New Year to y'all.
Thank you.
And Happy New Year to you too, Noel.
Thank you so much, Fran. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line. Give us a shout. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. Really, recently, President Biden approved $500 million arms package for Ukraine. But really, the most important question is, where do we stand today? What is the status of this war? And where do we see it going in the very near future? Daniel DePetra's Defense Priorities Fellow joins us. He authored a piece that said why neutrality is the best course for Ukraine. And he lays out a lot of important details moving forward. And he joins us. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, Daniel, where does this $500 million arms package really come into play here? I mean, it seems as though in many respects it was symbolic of the Biden administration trying to prove that there's still going to be this commitment, and they're still trying to hold together the West relative to its commitment to Ukraine. How do you see this?
Yeah, so this latest $500 million tranche of military aid is really nothing new. I mean, the administration has been sending, you know, the Ukrainians hundreds of millions of dollars every 2 months or so And this, of course, is an extension of what Congress authorized last year, which was about $60 billion in assistance. And that has essentially lasted for the last 12 months. And when Trump comes in January, he'll have another $3.8 billion on the table that he can spend until that assistance is finally out. And, you know, and then, of course, the question is, does Trump go back to Congress and ask for more military aid? And, you know, the Ukrainians are obviously very concerned about Trump not doing that. So that's where we are. And it's basically another example of Biden trying to provide Ukraine with the assistance it needs to keep with the territory that it has as Trump comes in.
As I was reading your article, you know, it's the war in Ukraine enters its fourth year in late February. And I reflected, I'm like, oh, my God, it's been 4 years already. And I got to imagine a lot of other people get slapped in the face with that same reality when they start reading it.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I'll be perfectly honest with you, Newell. When this war happened back in February 2022, you know, myself, among others who kind of observed Russian military capabilities, kind of assumed that this war would be over within, you know, a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months at the latest. Because, you know, looking at the balance sheet, the Russians had an extraordinary amount of people that they could throw into the fight. They have a population four times the size of Ukraine, so they have more men that they can enlist. But the Ukrainians, you know, thanks to our assistance and thanks to, you know, to some extent, the European assistance. But first and foremost, thanks to the Ukrainians themselves, that they've been able to really bloody Russia's nose over the last 3 years. You know, that does not at all mean that the situation on the ground is necessarily great for Ukraine at the moment, because it isn't. But, you know, looking back, this war has certainly gone on far longer than many people assumed when it first began.
The most recent happenstance of shutting off the pipeline, is that still the case? And what is the what are the downstream implications of saying?
Yeah, you know, there's been an assumption, I think, and a suspicion that when Trump comes in, that he will, if not completely shut down the pipeline of weapons to Ukraine, that will, you know, decrease the amount of assistance that Washington is willing to give. I know there's several reports that say that one way that Trump plans to coerce Ukraine into negotiations is to basically read them the Riot Act and say, you know, if you don't cooperate in my diplomatic initiative, we're going to, you know, decrease your aid. I don't know if that's true or not, quite frankly. I mean, there's a lot of reports that we can read, but I don't think anybody really knows what Trump is going to do. And quite frankly, I don't think Trump knows what he's going to do at this point. It really, everything is open in the air. And when people assume what Trump is going to do, I always kind of remind them that this is a man who values kind of unpredictability as a strength and an asset in how he operates. So I think we should all kind of sit down and wait until what his actual policy is going to be.
The same can be said, though, that we really don't know what Putin's going to do, do we?
Well, yes and no. I mean, we do know that Putin is sort of interested in, of course, improving relationship with the United States. And he believes he can do this. There's a higher probability of doing this with Trump in office rather than, you know, the alternative, which was Kamala Harris. And I suspect, I mean, we heard from the Kremlin this morning that, you know, Putin's spokesman basically said that we are open to direct negotiations with Trump as soon as Trump is ready to talk. So I don't think there's any question that Putin would like to speak to the United States about Ukraine. Kind of the unknown is, of course, why Putin would provide any concessions at the moment when his forces are still kind of gaining ground in the east of Ukraine. It just kind of seems nonsensical.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the Ukrainians want to regain their presence in Crimea. And obviously, there's a large section of the Donbass that is now in Russian control. And as you just pointed out, I can't imagine they would cede that back to the Ukrainians by any stretch of the imagination.
No, and it's very low probability that that would happen. Putin has kind of intimated again and again over the last 12 months that any negotiations will have to start out with the prospect of Russia holding the territory that it currently has. And in fact, he's actually demanding the Ukrainians withdraw from the entire Donbass region, in addition to two provinces down in the south that the Russians don't even have full control over. So, you know, whether this is a maximal negotiating position, or if he's actually serious about this, the only way we could actually find out one way or the other is by actually talking to the man and seeing if he's really ready to provide some sort of serious diplomacy, or if he's gaslighting us. We just don't know at the moment.
And as you said, kind of the cloak over all of this is this threat of becoming a member of NATO, and you know, this neutrality issue that the Kremlin has put out there, saying, you know, that is something that has to be dealt with, that you are not going to be a future member of NATO. Obviously, they don't want that to happen, but either, right?
Right, and this is not only a position from Putin. I mean, presidents, you know, Boris Yeltsin, back when immediately after the Soviet Union collapsed, he had the same position. And the Russian political establishment, regardless of where you are on the spectrum of that establishment, they do not want Ukraine in NATO for understandable reasons. Whether you sympathize with that position or not is sort of irrelevant. But, you know, if you're a policymaker, you kind of have to understand where Russia is coming from. And the record is pretty clear. The Russians are not going to tolerate any security arrangement in which Ukraine is in NATO as a member state or even a de facto member state. And, you know, frankly, Ukraine is, it's always referred to as the kind of the crown jewel of the Soviet Union. And I don't think Putin has really kind of given up that axiom. You know, we're no longer in the Cold War, but Russia under Putin still very much values Ukraine as a central piece of the quote unquote Russian world. And of course, we disagree with that position, but we do have to understand it as we go through these negotiations or prospective negotiations.
I mean, when you think about it, just from an agricultural standpoint, it's a huge win for the Russians to regain Ukraine, right? The breadbasket of that whole different area. I mean, if they had that, it would make Russian life a lot easier.
Well, I'm not sure if it's, you see, that's the thing. Why is Putin, I think that goes back to the central question, is why did Putin start this war in the first place, right? Is it strictly to gain territory? Is it strictly to basically capture Ukrainian agricultural land and kind of Ukraine's manufacturing capacity in the east of the country? Is it basically to shock the West into maybe rejiggering the European security, the security architecture over Europe writ large? It could be all four of those things, honestly. It's just very difficult to read a guy like Putin, who is obviously keeps his cards very close to his chest. And Trump, I will say Trump has a very, very hard hill to climb on this. He wants to clearly negotiate a settlement soon, within 100 days. And I heard a report, yesterday, that he's hoping the first 6 months of his administration, he's going to be focusing on getting a peace agreement. But, you know, there are no guarantees in negotiations, as he knows during his status as a private real estate developer. So he can have all the initiative and ambition he wants, but whether reality cooperates is an entirely different question.
One would agree, though, Daniel, that there are some things that are apparent, right? I mean, it's going to be hard to rebuild our military when we're sending billion upon billion upon billions of dollars over to Ukraine.
Right. And it's not only the money. It's, of course, the munitions that we send over to Ukraine. And I'm really speaking first and foremost, most about the anti-air and air-to-ground and air-to-air munitions that are really in short supply. And you know, the U.S. industrial complex, defense industrial complex is huge and has a lot of money, but it hasn't been able to produce these munitions to meet the demand that we have. And of course, you know, when people say we need to bring, you know, we need to send all these weapons to Ukraine, I always kind of try to remind them, well, you know, the United States is obligated through contractual obligations to send some of these weapons to Taiwan as well. So it's not just Ukraine that is receiving weapons. It's you know, it's Taiwan, it's members of NATO and Europe. It's part of, you know, our friends in East Asia, Japan, South Korea. They all have orders as well. And that obviously places a huge stress on the U.S. and defense industrial complex. And the war is stressing it even further.
As you watch this unfold, how extended is our defense industrial complex?
Oh, it's very extended. I mean, some of the same munitions that the Ukrainians are asking for every other week, you know, our allies and partners in Taiwan and East Asia are asking for. And we just, you know, realistically, we just don't have the bandwidth to supply everybody with all of the weapons that they're asking for and requesting. So it's certainly on the minds of people in the Pentagon who are responsible for making sure that orders are not only placed, but kind of, you know, implemented and finalized in a timely fashion. And this has been a longstanding problem, despite all the money that the Pentagon gets every fiscal year. But like I said, the war is a very intense conflict, very intense ground conflict, a war of attrition. And it's driving the Pentagon to quite frankly, to the breaking point in fulfilling a lot of these defense orders.
Who would be of our allies, because I'm totally ignorant of this, and it's why I'm asking, and I think it's appropriate to ask, is who would be the next largest defense industrial complex that's out there amongst our allies?
You know, that's a very good question. I'm by no means an expert on defense industrial conflict, you know, apparatuses across the globe, but I know the South Koreans have a huge defense industrial complex. And as a matter of fact, they've actually helped the United States with what they call 155 millimeter munitions, which is one of the munitions that the Ukrainians are sorely in need of as they defend their lines in the Donbass. Japan has an extensive defense industrial complex as well. But the problem with Japan is that their export controls are very stringent. So, you know, the Japanese are very reluctant historically and in terms of legally to actually export stuff to other countries, particularly if countries are in the middle of a war. That's still technically forbidden under Japanese law. So we do have partners with strong defense industrial complexes, and you know, their production is pretty swift, but it's a lot of these legal problems that the Pentagon has been dealing with that kind of stymie distributing the weapons.
Yeah, because we do have to be mindful of our own inventory, right? And I know there's been a lot of criticism on the Hill about whether or not we're truly paying attention to our own stock here.
Right. And I think competing parts of the Pentagon are sort of at war with each other, you know, metaphorically speaking on this point. You know, folks in Asia are trying to remind people that are responsible for U.S. policy in Europe that, you know, Ukraine, as important as it is or as important as we think it is, it's not the be all and end all for U.S. national security. There are other priorities outside of Ukraine that deserve attention. And of course, you know, I'm talking about Taiwan and our position in East Asia generally, and even our maintenance and readiness on the home front as well. But these are all need to be taken into consideration. And I think sometimes we lose a sight of that.
Daniel, I've been throwing a lot at you this morning, but I'm, if you don't mind, I'm going to throw more. I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are of the signaling of what's going on relative to these ships dragging their anchors and yanking out internet cabling and, you know, fiber optic cabling that's running across ocean bottoms, you know, in areas between China and Taiwan, obviously in the North Sea as well. What do you take away from this? And is it signaling or of some sort?
I think part of it is signaling, and I think a bigger part is just a continuation of what we call a gray zone tactics, which basically means penalizing an adversary or making the life of an adversary more difficult, but not going to the point of unleashing, you know, a war against that adversary. So it's a very low cost, high impact way to create problems for enemies and competitors. And, you know, the Russians are very good at this, and they have a long history of doing this going back to the early Cold War. They've been doing it to Europe pretty extensively, really since even before the war in Ukraine began in 2022. But, you know, the Russian activities in Europe have accelerated pretty markedly since the conflict in Ukraine began. And, it, you know, it's a way for the Russians to hit back without risking a full-scale war against NATO. And I believe we'll probably continue to do that.
When we also look at, and I spoke to some folks the other day on the show about Chinese hacking, it seems as though this is some of, I guess those are some of the same gray zone tactics that you're talking about, right?
That's absolutely correct. And it's not only kind of putting our U.S. cybersecurity defenses on high alert, but it's also, of course, stealing information that the Chinese may be able to use in certain scenarios in the future. So, you know, with the Russians, it's very kind of reactive and retaliatory. For the Chinese, I think they use those gray zone tactics kind of in a more holistic way and in a more preparatory way. So both countries are very pro what they call, like, you know, disinformation tactics and sending operatives overseas to steal trade secrets. You know, both countries do it. But I think the Chinese are more capable over the long term, especially on the cyber front. You know, they've been stealing trade secrets from the Americans for well over a decade, two decades, three decades. It's really a long history of them doing that.
You know, it's interesting, as a layperson has kind of been watching this from afar, right? And I certainly don't know probably 1/1000th of what you know, but I feel kind of uneasy right now. This transition that we have from, you know, the Biden administration to the Trump administration, it seems like I wasn't familiar with that term, gray zone tactics. But as I look at that basket of that, it seems as though there's a lot more out there and they're kind of testing the waters, seeing what the reaction is going to be. It just seems like we're kind of in a tenuous position right now. Your thoughts?
It's hard to know whether we have an increase in gray zone tactics or whether the United States is just better at sort of monitoring them and catching them in the act. You know, it's certainly hard for me sitting on the outside to determine, you know, what the explanation is. But I would agree that, you know, during periods of political transition, you know, whether we're talking about the United States or even in European countries, regardless of what country we're talking about, political transitions can frequently be used by competitors and adversaries as periods of opportunity, right? To kind of see what our reaction would be. And testing a new administration in the beginning of their term is not new. And it's actually a part of statecraft that we have to be cognizant of.
And we actually have a lot of that going on around the world right now, right? In a lot of our allies, when you think of what's happening in Germany, when you think about what's happening in France, what's happening in Canada, and I'm sure there are others that I'm not even aware of. But there's a lot of that's revealing itself at the present time.
You know, we often say democracy is kind of the best political system that mankind has made up, and that is true to an extent, but it's also kind of a vulnerable system, right? Because it leaves open our autocratic adversaries in Russia, China, Iran, and to some extent North Korea. They understand that democracies are a little bit more vulnerable in certain places. That doesn't mean democracies don't have the strength to defend themselves. Certainly not, but it does leave open, you know, another problem for aspiring leaders to pay attention to. And I'm afraid there's no one size fits all answer to a lot of the problems that we're facing today. That's the regrettable part of it.
Absolutely, no doubt. Thank you so much for joining us, Daniel DePetris, Defense Priorities Fellow. Truly appreciate your time and your insight, and really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
All righty. We will be right back, 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line. Stay with us. So there's a lot of, cause for concern as to what's actually going to happen out there in Ukraine. And we revisited that topic periodically to try and bring an update to our listening audience as to what's actually happening. And I really enjoy my conversations with Daniel DePetris and others. So let's pivot real quick. Los Angeles fire threatens Mount Wilson. Mount Wilson houses communication and broadcast transmitters, as well as the backbone for communications for first responders. And it seems as though firefighters are up on top of that mountain right now, trying to beat back a fire that's moving in that direction in an attempt to save the Mount Wilson Observatory. Evacuated the building. There's very few folks up there. There's a hell of a lot of communications equipment, broadcast equipment for really all every major broadcast station in LA. TV, radio, the list goes on and on and on. Things are changing fast. Things in some respects are getting better, many respects getting worse. If they lose Mount Wilson, they will have a huge problem in communicating amongst the first responders. Elon Musk's Starlink is due to arrive. Many of the folks are transitioning over to Starlink because they anticipate that, already they've lost power to Mount Wilson. And I guess they're on backup power at the present time. And obviously, if they lose Mount Wilson to reestablish communications connections in L.A., is going to take time. I don't know the level of redundancy there. I suspect if it's like a lot of other things that are going on there, there's probably not a lot of redundancy, and that's why they're asking for Starlink to come in. To be able to provide what's necessary for them to make the connections that they need in order to continue to do the work that they do, which is critical, right? We know what local radio and local television stations are able to communicate to the public, especially in the time of a call for evacuation or to be on a heightened alert. Look, my heart goes out to everyone out there, the first responder community who's being asked to do almost superhuman tasks out there with not a lot of assets and resources. When you're a firefighter and you don't have water, that's a problem, right? When you're a firefighter and you're having to leave the line in order to go get water in a whole different community to load your truck because the actual water distribution infrastructure is impaired, that's a problem. When you're a firefighter and you learn that thieves have been stealing fire hydrants in order to get the salvage value of that, and there's some kind of market out there for that, that's a problem. And when you're a firefighter as well as EMS and law enforcement and others, and your containment numbers relative to a number of these fires haven't moved in a 3 to 4 day period of time, and in some cases containment is still at zero, that is a huge, huge problem. Think about it, folks. Keep them in your thoughts and prayers, and hopefully things start changing really, really soon. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. Dock workers in the shipping industry reached a deal this past Wednesday to avoid a strike that could have wounded the economy, and obviously it would have created a big issue for President-elect Donald Trump just days before he took office. He'll be taking office on January 20th. President Trump's bold stance helped prevent a second coast-wide strike at ports from Maine to Texas, the head of the International Longshoremen's Association said in a separate union statement on Facebook. The union statement did not mention President Joe Biden at all, which kind of serves as a little bit of a last-minute embarrassment, according to Politico, for the outgoing Democrat who repeatedly called himself labor's best friend. And it's also a significant victory for Trump, who has been attempting to shear the rank-and-file union support away from Democrats for months now. And this same long head of the Longshoremen's Unit, he praised on Trump for helping smooth the way for the deal. It looks as though President-elect Trump has beat back the threat of this strike and helped facilitate a deal, being consummated. All right. When we return after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with the state treasurer, John Fleming. We'll be talking about Net Zero Banking Alliance. A number of more banks have exited from that alliance. And at 12:30, we'll talk to Diana Furchgott-Roth about coal in the world.